Ready to go? Excellent. Okay, so welcome to the wonderful November retreats, which we do every year at Jhana Grove, but this year we're doing it in October because just the way things work out. And it is, for me, it's very nice to be back here teaching an ordinary retreat instead of doing it on Zoom. The last time I was teaching here was for Akatina Day, which was a huge number of people. But before then, I remember during the COVID time that many of the events were cancelled because they had to be. And so we would give some talks sitting here to an empty room. It was still very useful, but I often noticed that when you give a talk to an empty room, but it's put on Zoom and going all over the place. But when you're actually talking to people rather than a camera, it's a very, very different feeling as a teacher. I look at your faces and just see whether you got the joke or or whether you understood what was being said. In other words, you get some feedback when it's live, face-to-face. And even though the talk would be eventually recorded and put online somewhere, and other people would also make use of it, still it's very thank you to all of you for being here to make it sort of alive and something which is much easier to teach and give some nice, wonderful, helpful, and sometimes original teachings of meditation. As you may know, but I've been teaching meditation for so many years, and I did last, I think it was, I give so many talks, I can't remember what I taught where, but I think last weekend, last Friday, at Dhammaloka, it could have been on a Saturday morning, I still recall, just as a school teacher in 1973, I think, having to have been asked to take the morning assembly at this high school. It was actually a grammar school over in Devon. And I asked the principal, would it be okay if instead of, because I was a Buddhist, is it okay instead of just giving talks to actually to teach meditation? And he didn't know what meditation was, hardly anyone did. And says, it's a Buddhist thing to keep you nice and quiet and peaceful, and he was really into it. So he gave me the authority to teach meditation to 650 high school kids. Now, finally about 5 minutes, from 11 years of age to 17 years of age, who'd never done any meditation before in their lives. And it was a wonderful experience. The most amazing thing was everybody, all those students, they all cooperated, which was quite an amazing thing. And when I told them, okay, now sit up straight, I always remember this, that all the children who were hunched over and leaning all sorts of ways, they all sat up straight, like a big wave of children straightening up. And just put your hands in your lap, the right hand over the left hand, and they all did that. Close your eyes, tuck your chin in, and then I taught them a very brief breath meditation for 5 minutes. And there were two things which were strange about that experience. Number one, they all cooperated. Not one child sort of started laughing, which was like a miracle. And number two, when I'd finished and said, okay, the meditation's over now, they all clapped. They gave me an ovation. And all that year I was at that school, that's the only time I ever heard anyone get an ovation like that, which was quite strange that somehow or other, in a high school in Devon, in about 50 years ago, no, maybe 46 years ago, 47 years ago, somehow or other, the meditation touched all those children. And one of the results of that was many, many years later, when I had already ordained as a monk, and I was visiting that part of UK, that this gentleman came up to me. He knew I was giving a talk somewhere, so he made a point to come listen to me and also to just to check in with me. And he was one of these fellows who comes up to me and says, "Do you remember me?" Now, when you give lots of public talks, of course, you know, you can't remember everybody. So please never be upset if you come and ask me and say, "Do you remember me?" And I said, "No," because I've got to be honest. And that's what I said to this gentleman. And he laughed and he said he was one of those kids. And he said just that little meditation for 5 mornings, 5 minutes each, had changed his whole life. And when people say that to you, and you can't remember him, but he certainly remembers you, it makes what you do teaching meditation so worthwhile. And it doesn't mean that a person gets enlightenment or gets jhanas or nimittas or anything which is really strong and wonderful. Some of you do get those things. But for him, he just got a taste of peace and a taste of something which he wasn't being told this. He could feel it for himself as something personal, which is the ability just to close your eyes and to stop thinking, stop planning or remembering, and just to go inside and find some silence was just so wonderful for him. And of course, and that was my experience as well, the first time I meditated as an 18-year-old student. And just going into a room, giving some basic instructions, following them, and just feeling that this was something quite special. And I know it was special because I was a 18-year-old student, so that was 51 years ago. A long time. Much of what I did at that time I can't remember at all. But that I remember. In the Wordsworth room of King's College in Cambridge, they hired that room just to do a little meditation class. And it got me the first time. It was 5 minutes, and I was peaceful. A type of peace which I never experienced before. Yeah, I'd been to nice, beautiful places and parks, and even some remote places. But this time was not looking outside, it's not listening to things. Those parts of my sensory apparatus were mostly closed down. I was just feeling inside, just watching my breath. And it was peaceful. And it had a sense that something was really important here. And of course, you never know why. But of course, then that just led to what I was doing in my whole life. Yeah, I'm a monk, a teacher. But I always say that, you know, what I really am is just a meditator. Because that's what really I enjoy all the time. And no matter what happens to me in my life, any difficulties, problems, even sicknesses, you always have the option, because, you know, been doing this for such a long time, to know what to do. Just to close your eyes, close your ears, close your mind to the past and future, and just allow everything to become quiet and still. There's huge amounts of energy coming up. And that energy just makes, there's a couple of things to say about that energy. It gives you a natural form of happiness and energy. Much better than tea or coffee. Tea or coffee gives you some energy, but this is something which is very difficult to describe, but pure. And it's not as long, it's longer lasting. And I was telling people recently that, you know, the last week, after finishing our range retreat and the Katina ceremony, it was a lot of work. And of course, you know, I'm responsible for a lot of that, and a lot of other people as well. And so you get quite tired, and I'm getting old now. It was wonderful the last week, still doing lots of stuff, going out for blessings and for Thai restaurants and houses and funerals and many, many stuff. We always have this option, this ability, this path, just to go back to my hut or my cave, really, where I stay, and close my eyes, sit down, and to feel tired. But to know what to do and how what happens, Yeah, you do feel tired. But then you just stay with the tiredness. You don't fight it. This is an important thing which I've learned, because if you're tired, you have low energy, because you've been working hard, doing stuff. If you fight that, you're wasting energy. And you know you haven't got energy to waste. So instead of fighting, I used to do that a long time ago, fighting, challenging. I'm not going to give in. I'm going to keep my head up. But no, these days I just let myself be tired. I have enough mindfulness, not great mindfulness, to know I'm tired and to leave it alone. And it's obvious what happens. If you're tired, low energy, you can't fight wasting your energy. You just allow the energy to come back again by preserving your energy. Sometimes you say, like, you know, using, say, a smartphone, your iPhone. If you're always, it's a slow battery, and you know, keep pushing it, thinking, as long as I keep it on, it's going to work. Of course not, it needs to be recharged. And to recharge, I just keep it still. I don't fight. In this moment, not worrying about the past and the future, not talking to myself with this inner thought conversation, just being. You know, every time you're just being, just here, it's called mindfulness. It's not being mindful of where you want to be next, it's where you are right now, it's tired. When I'm mindful of that, and don't fight it, in other words, let it be. It means that soon the energy comes back again. And it comes back not in a restless form. In the old days when I was, you know, practicing and trying to learn my meditation in Thailand, I was sometimes be so tired. And it was, I didn't realize at the time, it was just sometimes you can be so stupid. I was incredibly stupid that you think that, oh, it's because I was lazy. It wasn't laziness at all. It was just I was malnourished. I've solved that problem recently. But I really was malnourished. You see some of the old photos of me, you just can't recognize, because it was very bad food. And you know, in the northeast of Thailand, just where I practiced for 9 years, the soil was very sandy. So whenever it rained, there was plenty of moisture, but the water went right through the soil onto some other aquifers underneath somewhere. But it just washed all the goodness out of the soil. So it was very, very low, you know, the sort of nutrients which you need, even in the soil and the rice which come from that, any animals and, please excuse me, but that place, whatever crawled on the ground was eaten. And it was not very nice to see. But that's what the villagers ate, and that was subsistence farming. It was very rare to get vegetables or fruit, fruit only in season, obviously. So even the fruit and the vegetables, you know, they were very not so nutritious as down in Bangkok. So I was malnourished. And I don't know why that Ajahn Chah said this. He had some great teachings, but he was not perfect in the sense of always giving the best teachings. And I say that with the utmost respect to him. And he told us we should only sleep 4 hours a day. I was a young man. I just couldn't do that. 4.5 hours is all I could do a day. I got it down to 4.5 hours. But in the morning time, you were so sleepy. So you didn't sleep in the bed. You slept when you were meditating. It was a crazy thing to do. And so the experience which made it quite clear to me, so I don't go through theories. I go through experience. The experience which changed so much for me was just having to go to Bangkok to do my visa. And so, number one, we had decent food. You know, not Western food, but, you know, it was, even the rice was, you know, richer, had more stuff in it, nutrients in it. And, of course, you know, food which was, even the vegetables were richer. And we managed to find a room in this wealthy monastery, which was air-conditioned. So in the morning, we'd turn the aircon on and have it a cool temperature rather than this really hot, steamy, like sauna-like temperature, which was in the forests. And I could have a much longer sleep because I didn't have to get up early in the morning. And the result was so clear, so amazing. You went into the room there thinking, oh, here we go again, sleepiness. And instead, you were clear right from the very beginning. And it made the meditation so much more easy, enjoyable, and fruitful. And so, first little teaching for all of you on this retreat here. Don't push yourself too hard. Be aware of your need for sleep, of eating not too much, not too little, so you feel good. There's enough nutrients in there to keep your sensory apparatus clear. And find a temperature which is okay for you. You can see that I've got my bare shoulder on now. This, honestly, for me, this is beautiful temperature. I don't feel cold at all. And because I was brought up in UK, it's a cold country. And parents were quite poor, so we didn't have much heat in the house. So I got really used to this. This is wonderful. Of course, I could see all of you with the blankets on and on top of your other jumpers and stuff. And I think, crikey, you must be so boiling in there. But it's different people, different things you like. So please make sure you have enough blankets and enough jumpers to keep reasonably warm. Don't try and compare yourself to others. And you don't have also to meditate in this hall here. It's a nice place to meditate. I like it in here. It's got a bit of an energy building up now. But you find that over the years, the halls and places, they actually become more powerful places to meditate. Even the place picks up some of the power. And if you don't believe me there, that on the afternoons or mornings when it's not a talk, or actually there's a talk most mornings, afternoons, really encourage you to try to go over to Bodhinyana Monastery, the monks' monastery, and meditate over there in the hall. Because that hall's got really amazing energy. And I can say that, because hopefully you trust me. Other people who go into that hall, wow, that's great in there. There are some places I've found in the planet Earth that I don't know how you can't meditate peacefully. Got so much really good energy. And if you can, the closer you get to the front of that hall of Bodhinyana Monastery, the more energy you say. And you sit down there and you get very peaceful very quickly. So you can go to that place to meditate if you wish. Or meditate on the stupas outside, those nice stone monuments in the gardens between this hall and the kitchen, the dining room. Those were donated by a lovely monk in Indonesia, Venerable Sri Panyawado. I met him the last trip I did over to Indonesia. I met him over there and said hello. Over in Medan, he was over there. And he donated those, his supporters, for our retreat center. And they're exactly the same stone as the monuments in Borobudur in central Java. And they are 1.08% bigger than the ones on that monument, because 108 is a special number in Buddhism. I just got that out of the top of my head. 108. But anyway, he was very happy to make it 108. It's almost exactly the same size. And they're very beautiful to sit on. Or, even at night time, and there's no one else around, and it's not too cold, It's a clear sky. Just to lay down on your back and see the Milky Way. It's a beautiful experience. And then it's incredible, just the clarity of the sky in this part of the world. And obviously that been smelling a few of the cool burns in the area. We know we're in a forest, so we have bushfires in the hot season. So the bushfire brigades locally are doing cool burns, controlled burns, to lessen the fuel load, to make it safer for the months of January and February. So sometimes there's a bit of dust in the air, but a lot of times it's perfectly clean air. You lay on the back on those stupas and just watch the stars. And it creates a great sense of peace inside your mind. And I mention that because sometimes people say, isn't that sort of indulging in beautiful sights? There's one thing which I always question myself, because I saw many, many times the Buddha and these monks and nuns in the time of the Buddha praising, watching the beautiful scenes of nature and delighting just in watching the animals in nature. Even I don't mind saying that one of the monks just an hour ago, was showing me little pictures. There's a mother rabbit who lives by his hut over the other side of the road. He's got little babies. I never knew that rabbits did this. That she actually buries the babies in the ground. She's got a little spot, and she buries the little babies in a hole. And he showed me the picture of her digging out the soil, and you know, where the babies are buried, and then the babies come out to feed, you know, on her breasts. And then after finishing, she buries them again. She'll come back the next time to feed them. Really cute. I've never seen that before. But anyway, so much stuff in nature, which you see, is delightful. Again, if you go over to Bodhinyana Monastery, especially because animals over there are used to human beings and they don't run away. There you've got the little baby kangaroos, little joeys, all bones and legs, but they really bounce through the forest. And this is 46 years, no, how many years here? About 37 years I've been watching those little joeys come out. I always look forward to it this time of the year. It's always makes me laugh and brings a smile on my face. There's so many beautiful parts of nature, and the Buddha said, no, you can enjoy those. I thought, isn't that indulging? No, it's because nature is something which you cannot own. You cannot control. You can enjoy, but you have to let it be, leave it alone. If you try and capture the beauty of nature, you destroy it. The animals are afraid and run away. Or one of those anecdotes from my own life, when I was a Buddhist already, and just before I became a monk, I decided to go to India to see the holy sites. The first time I went on pilgrimage, and that was 1973, I think. Yeah, about that time. And going over to India, one of my goals was to see the Himalaya mountains. But I didn't do much research. And so I went during the rainy season. If you go to India in the rainy season, you can't see the Himalayas. There's clouds everywhere. And so, you know, try for about a month to realize no way you're going to see the Himalaya mountains. So there's many other things to do there as a young man. Just before I started my teaching. And teaching in school, that was. So anyway, that we found out when I was just staying a few days in Kathmandu that there was a post office bus. We'd go two or three times a week to the border, way up north over many passes, to the border with China, the border with Tibet. So that's a nice thing to do for the day. So we went up and I got on the post office box. It was probably illegal, but you know, the guy driving the bus, a few extra rupee, whatever it was, for him. So that was not a problem for us or for him. So when we got far up close to the border, he stopped for some tea or some dinner or something, lunch. So two other men were in the bus. We saw a little hill, so we all went up the hill. Only about 20 minutes or half an hour to the top. And as soon as we got to the top, oh, it was wonderful. The clouds cleared. You could see the whole range of the Himalaya Mountains. Oh, it was spectacular, especially when it was a surprise. It was one of the goals. Now I could actually see it. But the problem was, I had a problem that I left my camera in the bus. Stupid. I ran down as fast as I could to get my camera, ran back up again. Probably took a half an hour, no, 15 minutes down, 20 minutes up or something, steep hill. By the time I got to the top, I actually saw the clouds come in and close up again, as if they did that on purpose to teach me a lesson. And the other two guys up there, the Americans, they would say, "Where were you? It was beautiful. We wonder where you got." And I never saw them again that trip. On other trips I saw the Himalaya Mountains, but that was a great lesson for me. You can't capture the beautiful times of nature, which is why that enjoying parts of nature teaches you a lot how to watch the peace of your own mind. You can't control, you can't take photographs of your peaceful meditations. They're personal experiences, and you can't control them. You have to let them be. And there they are in all their beauty and wonder. And just like nature. And I really think that's one of the reasons why, especially for monks in the strictest of traditions, we're always allowed to enjoy like beautiful sunsets, star scenes, animals, because you can't hold them. You enjoy them for a moment, and when they're ready, they go. Just like the beauty of the mind. It doesn't belong to you, but you can witness it in all its finery. So anyway, little by little, we learn just how not to fight the mind. And even the times in this retreat when you do get peace surprises you sometimes. Sometimes the times you least expect. You're just sitting there and everything comes together. You get very peaceful and just get blissed out. And there's wonderful things happen in your meditation. Wow. You know what happens when that first happens to you? You think, wow, I know how to meditate now. Yeah, sure. After that, you go back to normal again. It's a struggle. But actually, it does teach you a lot about what meditation is. The ability to let go, allow things to happen, to create the causes. Get all the causes there in place, like, you've had enough sleep, enough food, you feel good, you're comfortable, not too cold, not too hot, good health, and then comfortable position in your body. And then, woof, everything is just right, and then wham, bam, you have a great meditation. You didn't do it. You just allowed it to happen. Always say that. It's not under your control. You're not the owner of this. You just almost like get out of the way, and all the obstacles, impediments are all just disappeared. And then, wow, and then these things happen. You learn so much from this. What you learn is just how these things happen. The beauty of life is there, but you try and chase it and it runs away from you. The deepest meditations are so shy. You try and give them a name and they run away. And they hide. So little by little, but I was saying just how it gives amazing energy. And it was only just this last week. And sometimes you read all these suttas, you know, you hear them, you study them, you teach them to others. And it's one of my favorite suttas. It's called the Nalakapana Sutta. And there, you know, it just says that without, you know, the deep meditations, especially says the jhanas, without those deep meditations, these five hindrances which actually block wisdom happening, and, you know, block the mind being seeing clearly, and block the deep meditations themselves. But you have to, by developing those deep meditations, that one of their results is these five hindrances, they disappear for long periods of time. Just a quick, for those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, five hindrances, you know, wanting and ill will. Whenever you want something, it disturbs the mind. Ill will is another type of wanting. Sloth and torpor, with the dullness of the mind, the restlessness and worry, the agitation of the mind, and a special form of restlessness, which is doubt, always asking questions, not at the right time. Those five hindrances stop you seeing the truth and stop you being peaceful. It says when those deep meditations happen, those five hindrances are just subdued. They're not just there, they're disappeared, or they're very, very weak. But also, the other two things which really came to my mind the last week, which are also missing, is discontent and tiredness, weariness. It's a special Pali word called tandi, the arati and tandi just disappear. And especially like the weariness, the tiredness, for an old monk who works too hard disappears. So you energize, ooh, this feels good. And the discontent. Oh, I don't know why these other monks don't come here to listen to a talk. Oh, what are they doing this evening? Oh, well, they're probably meditating really wonderfully well. But it's so easy to have a fault-finding mind and to have, like, discontent. When you have great meditations, all that discontent vanishes. Oh, let those monks, whatever they're doing a wonderful job. Oh, the nuns not being here for this retreat. There's usually some nuns every retreat here, but this time they decided not to come. I think they're supposed to be doing some work over there, getting ready for the bushfire season. But, yeah, you can get discontent. It's always nice to see the nuns over there. But it's good enough. So you can see that when you have decent meditation, that type of mind, which can't be content, you know, just where you're sitting in the dining room. Oh, I want to sit somewhere else. Why does everybody else get the nice view? And me, all I see is the wall. Why? Why? All that disappears. You have wonderful energy, no discontent. Mind becomes clearer with the meditation. And it's a wonderful way to live. The other little thing which I've been talking about, because it's just somebody gave this a new name which I hadn't heard before. There's lots of time that people give names to things which makes it more powerful because other people can share what you know. They put a name and you recognize it. And that particular name was, the name was called, was it, sensory enhancement. One of the other names which... which I was liking a couple of years ago, because I've come across this very often when people are about to die, they become very clear. People with Alzheimer's, they can last few minutes of their life, they can remember everybody. And it's called terminal lucidity. It's a medical term. And I love those terms. Because now you've got a name for something which I remember reading about it first in a book by Leo Tolstoy. But it has a word for it. When people are dying, it's a very important word because that does make it very clear. If any of you get so sick and you're dying and they're giving you sort of morphine or something, there's no worries about taking it because that just dulls the pain out for a long time. Yeah, you're in a fog when you're under morphine. I've never had morphine, but this is what other people tell me. You're in a fog. Your mindfulness is very, very weak when you're taking morphine. But don't worry, because right at the very end, when it counts, you get terminal lucidity. You're clear. So it's a wonderful way of making sure that the doctors and the other staff and your relations who are around the bedside are not getting worried about your pain and discomfort, and you know that you're going to be clear at the very end, which is what's really important. But the other one about sensory enhancement, there was a little article which I read, I think in the ABC, or the BBC, I think, because they're talking about hermits. You know, people who, not just monks and nuns, but lay people who just go off to quiet places and live alone for long periods of time without any TV or without any internet. So they really are alone. And after a while, they get used to the solitude. And one of the things which they discover and experience is their senses become like amplified, enhanced. So just what you hear is clearer and it's more beautiful. And what you see, the colours are richer. Same thing you're watching, but it's more beautiful. Each of your senses is enhanced. Not like enhanced better than amplified, because amplified just means intensity. But enhanced means it's more beautiful, more easy to see and clearer and more beautiful. You get more wisdom from it. And that sensory enhancement is a common result of meditation. And it just happens. I tell the monks and others, some of the stories which I've had, the one which comes up because Nicholas was just checking I've got enough baked beans in my room. Because I like baked beans for breakfast. But the reason I mentioned that was because I just had done a 15-day meditation retreat in my cave at Bodhinyana Monastery. And just after the retreat was finished, of course, the first breakfast, they gave me some baked beans to eat over in Bodhinyana Monastery. And I remember just your mind was just so peaceful. And you're so happy and satisfied. And I just took one bean, just one little tiny baked bean, and put it in my mouth. And that blew my mind. It was incredible, the taste. The taste of that baked bean. You know, it has tomato sauce, but you can't just reduce it just to saying tomato sauce. It was an incredible, powerful combination. And it wasn't really sweet, and it was a bit sort of sour at the same time. You know, like tomato sauce is. But it was so full. And I just, one bean, I was just admiring, astonished, wishing to sort of, I don't know who sort of opened that tin, but there must have been a 5-star chef, because that was amazing what they got. And then you bit into the actual bean itself, and the texture of a bean, just one bean, was amazing. It just crumbled, in your teeth. You weren't crushing it to bits. You just very softly, because I was enjoying every texture of a baked bean. It was amazing. I never felt that before. And it was a delight. It could have been gone to some restaurant by a 5-star chef in Japan or something, and that one baked bean was much better than that. All because my senses had been enhanced. Just a little bit of solitude, spending time just in my cave and just meditating and just allowing the mind to become peaceful. That's the result of what we're doing. And I'm sure that'll happen to you. You just go to breakfast and maybe a piece of toast, and you just crush into the toast and the texture of a toast. And it's amazing as you bite into it, if you like porridge or whatever it is. Sometimes you think, I don't know who did the cooking today, but they must have been just really on the spot, that they made some incredible point. As you allow the taste and the texture and the heat of it, not too hot, not too cold, just to melt in your mouth. Wow, this is amazing. And you realize what's going on. It's not the cooks. The first retreat which I went to was in Cambridge. I was still a student. And it was in a, you know, the vacation time in a boarding house, three boarding houses, you know, for poor students in Bateman Street. It was amazing, my memory for these things, because they were powerful parts of my life. In Bateman Street in Cambridge. And when I booked in for my retreat, like you booked in for this retreat, and I thought, I'm going to enjoy the meditation, but the food. Because boarding house, you know, like England, they weren't really well respected in the rest of the world for their cuisine. And that's if you go into a good restaurant. And these were boarding house for students. So the worst cooks in the world who couldn't get a job anywhere else would cook for students. We couldn't complain. And it was true. It was usually, you know, we were all vegetarian on that retreat. It was actually just three vegetables, and they were boiled until there was no taste left in them, usually. But this time, again, it was quite striking. The food was actually quite tasty. Because, you know, I was in Cambridge, I thought I could just go around the corner somewhere and get some other food somewhere, or bring some sandwiches or something, you know, so I can get a decent meal. But every meal was delicious. And it stunned me. I thought it was the cook. It wasn't the cook at all. It was my sensory enhancement. Whatever flavour was actually left after all that boiling, I could actually pick up. It was delicious. And so much else of what I saw and felt on that retreat, you know, even like the wind. Sometimes if, actually I was doing that this afternoon, just walking down here, just stopping, just feeling the cold air. And it wasn't like cold, trying to get rid of it. It was actually really beautiful cold. It was rich and deep, and I felt it just way inside. And with pleasure, I was alive, feeling clean, invigorating, cool air. That's what happens when your senses get invigorated. Everything becomes so much more beautiful and happy. And it's one of the reasons, please, if you go to a retreat where the monk or the nun is not smiling and happy, ask for your money back and go home. If they don't know what meditation is and they don't do it themselves, what can they do to teach you? Because this is what's going to happen to you. You're going to get a natural smile on your face and you can't stop it. It's nature. If you don't believe me there, go and look up in the Dhamma Dhyana Sutta. No, that's not right. Dhamma Chaitya Sutta or something. The monuments to the Dhamma. Where is a lot of monks quote this sutta, because it's the one sutta which was so clearly said by the Buddha, that when one of the kings went to see the Buddha in the very famous Jeta Grove monastery, and he said to the Buddha, I said, I love coming to this monastery. I really enjoy it. I'm a king. I can just come and walk here. And I love it. And then the Buddha asked him, why do you love coming here? Why? And he said, one of the things, not just because the Buddha was living there, he said, because all the monks in this monastery are always happy and smiling. Have you been to other monasteries in the world? Are those monks, those teachers, happy and smiling? Yeah, you can ask that question. They're happy and smiling. And the Buddha said, yes, that's what you can expect when they're meditating properly and getting deep insights and understandings. Your senses get enhanced. And whatever you see is just beautiful and wonderful and lovely. So what you have on this retreat is a great opportunity to have real fun. I don't mean like jokey fun. I mean very deep fun. So when you go to bed, just the feeling of the blankets on top of you. Sometimes you don't want to go to sleep. It's just, you know, too wonderful. Or the, you know, the cleanliness of the smoothness of the linen sheets. There's so much you can feel and enjoy. And much more than if you're at home. And the reason is because it's one of the rewards of solitude, of restraining the senses. They become more powerful. You see much more, feel much more, and hear much more. Okay, this simile comes up. I might as well do it now instead of later on during this retreat. The simile of, people say I should get exercise. It's really hard to get exercise for a senior monk. As soon as I try walking, they say, no, come and get in the car. You're too valuable. Precious goods. So anyway, one day, it was an argument to actually get this privilege. Coming back early from some appointment, and I asked my driver, driving the car, to let me off at the bottom of the hill, the bottom of Kingsbury Drive. I said, I'll walk up. It's only 2.5 kilometres. It's not that far. Okay, it's a steep hill, but I was in no rush. So I started walking from the bottom, Southwest Highway Junction, up Kingsbury Drive. And I'd been up and down that drive so many times. I'd been, I think, about 6 or 7 years in that monastery when this happened. And I can now walk up. No rush, just enjoy myself, have a nice looking around. But when I started looking around, that really sort of shocked me. I could not recognize my surroundings. So, you know, what hillside am I on? And that shocked me. I thought I knew the road on which I lived. But when I got out and walked, it looked so different that, wow. So I stopped. I'm glad I stopped and just stared. Maybe if you do that in your street, you can't do that because people will actually call the police and take you away. They think you're strange. There's one thing which I learned the first year I came here. I was very happy to learn this because, you know, one poor gentleman, first weeks I was here in Perth, he had an epileptic fit, so we had to call an ambulance for him. And as they were calling the ambulance and the ambulance men came, one of the things they asked this man, he said, what day of the week is it? And he just had an epileptic fit, he didn't know. So they put him in the back of the van and took him off to the hospital. And I remember, I think I told Ajahn Chakra at the time, I'm really glad they never asked me because I didn't know what day of the week it was. So I always try and make sure that I know. Today's Friday, okay? So, okay, every day's the same here, but please make sure that you know which day of the week. So anyway, I was walking up the hill and stopped and stared. And that was just, again, one of those experiences which stays with you because I've never seen the hillside look so beautiful. Never. As just standing, staring. And when I stared, you could see just the colours. Now they grew in their beauty and richness. And the greens of the grass. Not ordinary green. It's just like everything had been clean and bright and wonderful greens and saw so much more detail. Now, there's a little brook in the valley in the bottom there and hardly ever noticed it. But there you could actually just see it, just see the little waterfalls and the nice little rocks with lichen on them. And I was just entranced and wondered, why hadn't I seen that before after 7 years looking through the window of a car? And of course, you know, having had a basics of science, actually more than the basics, theoretical physics, but realizing that when the light goes in your eye and hits the back of the eye, the retina, it's a chemical reaction. And that, you know, causes something to, some electrical impulse to go up your optic nerve, and so the brain can see what's going on. When you're looking through the window of a car, you see something, then you see something else, 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 then you see something else. None of those chemical reactions has a chance to complete. So what you actually see is like washed out, incomplete, blurred, never really the full picture. When I stopped, you could see the full picture. And my retina had all the time it needed to fill out all the details, and the colours could actually form fully, rather than just, you know, half or a quarter or an eighth or something. You saw everything really fully, and it was beautiful to see. At the time, you know, I wasn't really that prepared for how meditation experiences can be so happy. I thought, hang on, Ajahn Brahm, be careful, you get attached to that. Have you ever heard that before? If you're enjoying yourself, there must be something wrong. Please never think that way. But fortunately, you had good teachers. They said the opposite to you, but somehow or other, I sort of connected religion, spirituality with pain, suffering. Come on, suffer. Come on, sit longer till it hurts. Come on. I don't know why people do that. That's total ridiculous nonsense. And when things start to work and get peaceful and happy, people just throw it away. Why? This is what's supposed to happen. You're meditating or just walking up a hill and you stop. You see so much more detail of what's happening there. Wow, that's amazing. And now I usually always say this little quote from one of my favorite poets, William Blake. William Blake was also an artist as well. Did some amazing artwork, as well as a great poet. And this line was, to see a world in a grain of sand, a heaven in a wild flower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand, and eternity in an hour. And an hour is the time which I give my talks. They're always 1 hour long. But hopefully you don't think they're eternity. Only because a moment doesn't rhyme with flower. So that's why I'm sure he used hour. But anyway, it's a wonderful little statement there of enhanced perception. See a world in a grain of sand. Have you ever done that? You know, you're walking along the path, you see just a little tiny leaf. You just look at it, and there's just so much going on in it. It's not just a tiny leaf, it's amazing stuff happening there. And the more you look, the more you see, and the more beautiful it is, and the more entranced you get, just a tiny leaf. And see the heaven in a wildflower. Wildflower only because they're tiny. It's not where you expect to have joy and happiness. But you look upon it and, well, it's like the mind opens up. It sees beautiful colours, richer colours than you've seen before. And hold infinity in the palm of your hand. That's a great line. Infinity, truth, meaning. Yeah, you've got it right here. It's not so you have to go searching for it or read it in an encyclopedia or go to some wise monk or nun to find it. It's yours, you have it, it's right in the palm of your hand. Wow. Amazing stuff. And if, eternity and now, just time has no meaning anymore. That's one of the troubles. That if you really get into the meditation, you don't really know what day it is or time it is. You're having a wonderful time. But please, you know, if you see a the people in the white coats come to take you away, just please remember what day it is. So you don't end up. But people are usually much better than that. So this is actually the enhancing perceptions, which is one of the joys of meditation. You come here and say, wow, this is such a wonderful way of spending 9 days. What was that case? This lady came from Sydney. You can't have anyone from Sydney today, I'm afraid, because of COVID. But she came from Sydney and she came up interviews and, oh, I had to... She had grovel, I think the word she said. I had to grovel in front of her boss to get permission to be away for a week from the office. Now, she had worked, she had the time, should have the time off, but, you know, the boss, oh, we need you, it's very busy, blah, 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 blah. But she grovelled and begged and said, OK, off you go. And she sent me this wonderful email when she got back to Sydney, the first day on a Monday. There's some of these emails I should have kept, but, you know, as a mind, you don't keep things. Give them away or throw them away or shred them or something. In fact, I love shredding things. As those people, ask Scotty or Lynn Jackson in Nolamara Centre. On the weekend, I always find something to shred in the shredder. It's one of my favourite devices. I don't know why. It's just because it disappears, it deletes. Anyway, so it disappeared, this email. But anyway, she said, my boss took one look at me when I came back from a retreat in this place here. And all he could say was, I don't know what drug they give you in Jhana Grove, but please bring me back some next time. I just saw straight away just, you know, the features of her face and the happiness levels were way up. That's what we're talking about, enhanced perception, so you see clearly. Now, for those of you more serious in your meditation, who want to really actually see how your mind works, of course you need enhanced perception. Audio perception just doesn't crack it. If you want to see what your breath is, just one in-breath. Imagine enhanced perception. If a baked bean just grabs my attention, it's so gorgeous and beautiful. Imagine one in-breath. And that's no exaggeration. Things become beautiful. Simple things like a breath. And later on, when we talk more about, oh my goodness, I keep going on. Later on, when we talk about the breath meditation, you know, say one of the pivot points of meditation is to see the delightful breath. You know, for in Pali, with Piti Sukha comes up with the breath, joy and bliss. This is crazy stuff. The breath, I've been breathing in all my life. Is that beautiful? Is that delightful? Remember, when your senses become enhanced. Wow. Even one in-breath. It's incredible. You don't do it. You're watching. Amazed at the power of your mind when it's enhanced. And you've got a bit of stillness and rest. Wow. And so this is the sort of things which happen in this meditation retreat. And I did take a look at the clock because sometimes, you can see, I just get myself enhanced perceptions and time doesn't make much meaning for me. But I know this is your first day, so I'm going to let you go soon to have a nice rest and sleep. And in the morning when you come up, first couple of days, I should always say this, first couple of days, please take it easy. Be kind to your body. So, I know that for many of you, you haven't come great distances because you can't because of COVID. But nevertheless, some of you have been working hard, arranging everything to be able to get here in time. So please, take it easy. Be kind to your body. Your body does not belong to you. It's your friend. Your colleague. If you're kind to your body, I said, "Buddy, do you need to go to bed now? Do you want something to drink? Be kind to your body, and then your body will be kind back to you." Simple, simple truth. And then he has, "Have a nice sleep tonight, body." Say, "Good night, me. Have a nice sleep." You know, I don't think I'm a crazy monk, but that's what I do. I say good night to myself before I go to bed. I say, "Good morning, me. Here I am again." Why not? Because then my body and I have a wonderful relationship together. If my body is a little bit tired or a bit sick, there's an ache here, a pain there, I focus on it. "What's wrong with your body today? Are you okay over there?" You know, sometimes just asking a person, "How are you? Are you okay?" Just, you know, having that bit of attention and care is one of the best medications you can have. All for free, very simple, very easy. I found that incredibly effective. Just blowing my mind effective. Just have some kindness and get rid of aches and pains and sicknesses and stuff. So be kind to your body tonight. When you get up in the morning, no need to, you know, beat your record and get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning, 3, 2 o'clock, I go to bed, just come and meditate again. Don't be stupid like that. I've seen so many people like that, mostly monks like that. And you always think, that, wow, they're going to get enlightened so quickly. That's what I thought when I was a young monk. They usually end up disrobing and just, you know, getting so fed up. And you ask them, "Why did you do that?" And they said, "Because they thought that's what you're supposed to do. What you're supposed to do. Who told you that?" So they said, "Oh, so I was supposed to do." But that's not what you do. It's what works for you. How do you feel? Does your body feel comfortable by doing stuff like that? And if ever you see me sitting down for long periods of time, it's because I'm just blissing out, I'm enjoying it. I'm not just trying to do a PB, personal best. That's crazy stuff. Just, you can't stop yourself and just, you're having fun. So please be like that. You wake up in the morning, first couple of days, if you need to take some extra sleep, like this one lady, again, this is an executive from Sydney, not the same lady, but you know, she was wonderful. Actually, this was a retreat over in Sydney. Came there, and she came at midnight on a Friday night, so I could only talk to her on Saturday morning. But she got it straight away, just what she should do. So after breakfast, she went to bed. It was in one of these dormitories, like 4 people to a room. So she went to bed after breakfast. She got up just before lunch, and after lunch went to bed again. She got up for the evening talk, and after the evening talk went to bed again. She did that for 2 or 3 days. She said, "The people with me were just in the same room. They were giving me such angry stares." I said, "That was not anger, that was jealousy." I only wish they had the guts to do the same. Because they were just sleep deprived. And, you know, she was executive working so many weird hours. And she took the opportunity to be kind to her body and sleep. And what happened next was the best part of it, because after 3 days, she caught up. The next 3 days, you know, she was the same as everybody else, and her meditation soon caught up with everybody else's. First 3 days, it was nowhere. But now she had a really nice body, you know, just nice and rested and got a bit of energy coming up. And then she started meditating really well. And by the end of the retreat, she was the star meditator of the whole retreat. And I told everyone about her. I said, "That's how to meditate. Know your body. Don't follow what you should be doing or what you think you should be doing. Just feel what your body needs. It's very smart, your body. What your mind needs as well. And then just go along. And you find after a while the body will just say, 'Thank you so much for looking after me.' It says, 'You're such a kind person in my body and you've looked after me. What do you want?'" I said, oh, nice hour, 2 hours sit without any aches and pains. The body says, okay. And it does that, just like everybody would do. If you give kindness, you get happiness. And so with your mind. Sometimes your mind thinking all sorts of stupid thoughts. Ask your mind, what does it need to do today? You want to think a stupid thought? And I said, yes, please. Okay, off you go. Think stupid thoughts. And after a while, the mind says, thank you, I needed to do that. And then afterwards, the mind says, what do you want to do now? Oh, like a jhana would be nice. Okay. And your mind cooperates. It's a friend. So you don't train your mind like a slave. You train your mind with wisdom and kindness. And then you have a wonderful time together. So anyway, I can keep on talking forever sometimes, so I better stop now. So I hope you enjoyed some of that today. And there'll be more tomorrow and the next day and the day afterwards and maybe. So anyway, I wish you a very happy night. And hopefully your cottage is nice. The first night it's always a bit because you don't know where you are. So make sure you have a nice sleep. You wake up in the morning, oh my goodness, where am I? You're perfectly safe in this place. And number two, whenever you want to get up, what time is breakfast in the morning? 6:45. Okay, 6:45 is your breakfast. We're chanting in the morning? If you don't want to do the chanting in the room over here, you can always do the chanting in your own room, in your bedroom. Snoring chanting. But be careful in the middle of the night if you get up, not to sort of decide to make yourself a cup of tea in the middle of the night and with your as you stir this milk or sugar in your coffee, whatever you take. So people always complain about that. People get up really early in the morning and they make so much noise. Instead, be the burglar. It's a burglar practice. I know, actually many of you are getting a bit old now, but it's a few young people. You haven't got a job. At least you can train about how to be a good a good burglar in this place. So you get up in the morning and no one knows. You get up. You know, we had one monk once over here. He used to be a Gurkha, you know, in the Indian army. He was a really lovely man. And the Gurkhas, I mean, they're really, really sort of dangerous people. So when the people in the Buddhist society and also the people who come every day to feed us, when they heard we were ordaining a Gurkha as a monk, they thought, oh, is it safe to come to monastery? Because they have this saying in the Gurkha regiment that you know the Gurkha has been in the middle of the night. The only way you know is when you wake up and you shake your head falls off. That's the way you know the Gurkhas have been. Well, this guy, even though he was a Gurkha and he had all the, you know, the tie and the medals and stuff, he was in the accountant arm of the Gurkhas. He never lifted a sword or a gun or anything. He was a really nice fellow. So, but anyway, see if you can be like a Gurkha or like a burglar. So you get up in the morning, no one knows you've got up. You can make a cup of tea or coffee, no one knows that you've made the coffee. It's just you stir it up so quietly that no one hears you. You can walk out and no one knows. You enter the hall here, quietly opening the door, walking in, quietly closing it, sitting down. No one knows. Wow. What wonderful training that is. That's also out of compassion for everybody else. Because over here, we don't have times you have to sit and you have to not sit. So you can use this hall at any time you like. But when you come in, please come in quietly. so no one knows you've come in. No, you boil water silently. It can be done. Gurkhas can do it. So whatever. So you can come in quietly and leave quietly. It's a great practice as well of mindfulness and kindness for yourself and others. It's not that hard to do. And have a wonderful time. I promised already. I've got to keep my promises. So it's enough. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay. And have a good night's sleep. And we'll see you in the morning or in the afternoon or whenever.